Welcome everyone to this week's OCCA seminar. And it gives me a pleasure to introduce Simon Lewis. And I don't need my notes because I have known Simon for 20 years, I guess. So Simon did his undergraduate, both his DPhil or PhD in Brazil, working in the Amazon, and then did a postdoc with me and Oliver Phillips, working on setting up a forest inventory network across Africa, which became the Africon network. And he's led the way in this synthetic analysis of forest dynamics and changes in forest dynamics, identifying the size of the carbon sink in African tropical forests. And that's continued. And then you have a joint UCL University of Leeds position. Previously as a Royal Society University Research Fellow, and now he's Professor of Global Change
Science.
Global Change Science at UCL. So I do need my notes after all. Simon's going to be talking about something that the last few years has become pretty prominent, and their description and discovery of these vast peatlands and the Congo Basin. So Simon.
Great, thank you very much. And I didn't realise it was the last day of the last Friday afternoon of term. So lots of great photos in this. So I'm going to talk about Congo's. Where do I point it? There we go.
Yep.
So I'm going to talk about trying to understand what's happening in the world's second largest tropical wetland. So after the Pantanal in the central Congo Basin. It's a story, a kind of slow story of discovery in January last year, 2017. We published first findings of this peatland, which suggests that it's the world's largest tropical peatland complex and is around the same size as England. But how did I get from living in London and working in London Leeds and get to there? And really, this graph summarizes kind of my concerns about what humans are doing to the planet. So this is ice cores for the last 450,000 years, and then direct measurements. And this is what we may do this century. And the terrestrial tropics are driving a big part of that response. And importantly, what have those changes in the tropics are going to impact the majority of the species that are here on Earth. So, as Edwina mentioned, this kind of started off with when I finished my PhD. This paper came out in Science. I think you were in a cohort, weren't you? Suggesting that actually these remote forests that I've been working in were not in equilibrium, and something was happening, and they were gaining biomass. So they were increasing on average mass over time. And with wider sampling, it appears like that these intact tropical forests are not in equilibrium. And it was really a quite controversial result initially about the methods and the drivers. And it confounded some, kind of equilibrium ecological theory. So I thought I would replicate this in the world's second largest expanse of tropical forest in Africa. So this is me. It's just to give you kind of understanding of the kind of scale of the forest there. And about 50% of tropical rainforest tree is of a dry mass of trees carbon. So if we measure all those trees, then we can get an idea about the carbon storage in the forest and remeasure them over time, get an understanding of the change in carbon storage. So I went about this trying to collect as much old data as possible and go and remeasure these tropical forest plots. An awful lot of work on the botany, because different species store different amounts of carbon for a given size. And this was my kind of first attempt at what was the sampling of the change in the carbon stock. And what you'll see here is it's kind of embarrassing, really. You know, there's just a huge area where we don't know anything. So I was kind of intrigued about what the hell, what's going on around here. I was kind of skirting around the edges of the main block of tropical forest. So we produce this result, and it's almost the same answer. So you have two continents, almost no species in common, identical methods, and we get identical results, suggesting that a global change driver is impacting these tropical forests. So just to kind of summarize where we were getting to, is that fossil fuel combustion putting CO2 into the atmosphere, and land use change, but not all of that is staying into the atmosphere. Some of it's going into the land surface, and a chunk is going into the terrestrial biosphere. And what we think from all this plot work is that tropics are a bit less than half that, and also the deforestation, degradation, and regrowth restoration function fluxes are opposite and very large. So we see that the tropics altogether are an incredibly important part of the overall global carbon cycle and can change fast. So I was still thinking about what's going on in the centre of here, and I knew that there's second largest wetland in the world there, and I have no information whatsoever on the tree carbon stocks or anything else that's going on there. So I've been working with the government of Gabon on their national forest inventory for carbon, and went to a meeting in Brazzaville of Congo Basin countries for forest management for RED, and said that I would take a chunk of time afterwards and try, you know, I had no contacts, to go to this wetland and see whether it was possible to work there, whether it was safe to work there, and whether I might be able to have some project to try and understand something about the change in the carbon balance of that system. So it actually turned out that there was an NGO working there and managing a community reserve in the north of the Republic of Congo in the swamp area. And it was safe to work, and I installed a first sampling plot there and went back to the UK to think, how can I get some funding to be able to do this on a reasonable scale and expand my sampling? And talking to colleagues, they discovered the peatlands in the swamps of northern Peruvian part of the Amazon, and that got me thinking, even though I'd never thought about what was going on underneath the water on the surface of these peatlands, of these swamps. So I started thinking, maybe there is peat there, and started looking in the literature, and the wetland's pretty well mapped, about the size of Germany. It's mostly swamp forest. And actually, from around the early 1950s, about once a decade, somewhere in the grey literature, in World Bank report, report from French Development Agency, there are references to peat, but no geolocations about where I could go and look, and I couldn't find any laboratory results. So we started off with satellite data, although satellites can't directly detect peat or peat depth. So it started off from a theoretical basis. We were places that are going to collect water to impede decomposition and therefore increase the likelihood that we have peat accumulation. So we're looking for year-round water logging using radar data from ALOS. digital elevation model to exclude slopes and look for where water might pool using SRTM, and we want to know that there's enough production of material going onto the ground to produce to have peatland accumulate. So we need high inputs and low decomposition. So we looked at this satellite data to go out on our first expedition and see what we could find, whether our hunches about the potential for peat might be there. So we have a dugout canoe and our friends here from the village of Itanga, and this is what the peatland, the hardwood swamp with peat underneath it, looks like. So it's got this very called black water in the Amazon. It's kind of full of tannins, tea coloured water, really beautiful. So the main work was done by Greta Dargy, so a PhD student of mine, an intrepid explorer of the swamps of the Central Congo Basin. She's lived there for on and off for 2.5 years, exploring the whole region. And yes, we did find peat. Not only did we find peat, we found peat almost everywhere we went once we'd gone a few kilometers away from the river access. So these maps have start to be pretty useful. So we can see going from black water to bright green, so high vegetation density, and then this magenta with a double bounce from both the stems of the trees of the radar and the wet soil, suggesting where we have this palm swamp forest. So then we could use our first couple of places that we've been to then refine our methods to prospect for more peat and then sample across this whole region over the next couple of years. And what we discovered was that only in year-round waterlogged conditions do we see peat forming under three different vegetation types: a hardwood swamp and two types of palm swamp, dominated by two different types of raffia species. One's very rare, occurring only in these small old channels, and one is very, very common across these large interfluvial basins. The maximum peat depth we found was almost 6 meters. It's actually kind of organic matter, is kind of organic rich material is actually at least a meter or so underneath that, but it doesn't quite fit the definition of peat, so 65% organic matter. And our median depth across all our sampling is around 2 meters, so not really deep peatland, but very extensive. So the question is when did this start? And some radiocarbon dates of the basal samples of the peat cores of the different transects suggest that the peatland initiated around 10,000 years ago at the African humid period, when Central Africa got warmer and wetter and then peat started to accumulate. There's a hint that at the end of the African humid period, and this central part of DRC was around 3,000 years ago, peat accumulation may have stopped, and it may even have gone into reverse. And we only have data from one core on this. And then for the last at least 2,000 years, it seems to have been steadily accumulating. And this suggests that it's a rain-fed system, that it's driven over long time scales by changes in the climate in terms of rainfall. So this is broadly what we think has happened. You have an infilling of grasses and sedges, marshy vegetation, and then this slowly accumulates to forest and then peat forming, and should, we expect, form a raised bog or peat dome. And we have a first preliminary data of the paleo ecological analyses from pollen from one core, and we see that there were fires and lots of grasses and sedges in the beginning, and then we start to have a switch towards hardwood swamp and then towards palm swamp. And it's the same kind of patterning that we see spatially across our mapping of the peatland vegetation. In terms of contemporary function, we also installed data loggers, pressure transducers to look at the water table, and again it suggests that it's rain fed and mostly waterlogged. So it in the dry season it is drawing down to around 20 centimeters below the surface where the water is at this particular site. Most of the time it's just the water is just a little bit above the surface, 10 centimeters or so. And this is just put out 1 month across three parts of the transect, and this is rainfall from satellites, from TRIM. So we see the rainfall events, and they correlate with increases in the water table, and then it decays down until we have another large rainfall event, and then it decays down. And October is the month where the nearest river to this site is at its highest, so we don't see any evidence across all the different places we're monitoring of inputs from river water and flood wave events. So we just don't see those. Guessing that it's the contemporary peatlands are peatlands because of the rainfall that they receive and the lack of drainage. But really, these transects, we were still only camping in the nearest village or nearby village, and then going, a maximum we could get is around 6 kilometers into the swamp. This is about the maximum time where we could cut a trail, get in as far as we can, take our samples, and get back out again in one day, because traveling through the peatland is pretty arduous. So we had a plan to say, we really need to know what's happening in the between space, equidistant between these two big rivers that we've been sampling along. So we work with the village of Itanga, where the team that we were working with from the local village saw the idea of going to the kind of middle of the swamp with the same kind of excitement that we did, of like this was a once in a lifetime opportunity to go and see what was really deep in the swamp. So they taught us how to live over time, build these little platforms, and then we put a tent on top, and how to have a fire in the peatland. And this guy's Akus, who did a lot of our trail cutting. His arms are like much bigger than my legs. He is like one strong man. So we trekked in for 3 weeks carrying all our own stuff, ferrying it in a kind of like a kind of old fashioned Victorian kind of mountain expedition where you kind of creep along a kilometer at a time, bringing the scientific equipment and the food supplies. And so we really did see over 26 kilometers that we see this increase in peak depth until this is around the middle between these two rivers, the Ubangi River and the Lipuala River. And we measured tree heights along the way, and so this is the right, tricky thing. So the tree heights on average are kind of slightly declining as we go across these 26 kilometers. But our two different remote sensing products to measure whether this peatland is domed, which is what we would expect if this is a rain-fed system, don't show domes. And actually, the combination of this change in tree height and ASTA and SRTM, which are measuring aspects of the forest canopy, we can't detect whether there's domes or not the uncertainty is too large on these remote sensing products to be able to get a handle on that. So we found some useful things in terms of the peak depth and getting some really deep cores for future paleoecological analyses, but we didn't discover what we hoped we might, which would be whether these peatlands are domed and therefore a signature of being rain-fed. So our hope in the future is that we will be able to do this with a unmanned aerial vehicle and LIDAR, where we'll get centimeter level accuracy across this transect about the topography of it. We haven't done that yet.
Simon, may I just ask a question?
Sure.
Why would you expect that to be there at dawn in the middle?
So,
if it is rain fed.
So, as the peatland develops and you have all this material input, and then it is not all decomposing, and it kind of acts like a sponge and absorbs the water, and therefore it's wet, and therefore not, and therefore slowing down the decomposition, and then allows you to keep going higher and higher, where you've been accumulating peat for longer, so therefore you'd expect this dome. And that's what's seen with these methods in Southeast Asia. You can use these methods and you can see these domes quite clearly. So these may be very, very shallow domes, or it may be just driven by this decline in the tree height, which is interfering with the signal of the dome when you look at these from space.
How high a dome would you expect based on Southeast Asia? Tens of meters, I think? Or?
No, so it can be maybe like six, seven, could be 8, 9, that kind of, and over a similar kind of distance.
And you've got the same kind of sphagnum mosses, or perhaps different kinds of sphagnum mosses.
There's not really that many mosses in there, to be honest.
Interesting.
So it's a tree-dominated system. Right. Or in the palms, then you can see some areas where it's a mix of both, but dominated by palms. And then these palms, and then in the really palm-rich, then it's can be areas where there's only palm, and it's a trunkless palm, so it's just these huge fronds of maybe 10 meters tall, 12 meters coming out of the ground, and then a whole of those spaced out. And there's not much else in those really extreme parts. And then in the hardwood swamp, it's like a kind of tropical forest with no big trees. There's a kind of more stunted smaller size class distribution set of trees there.
While you're disturbed, Simon.
Yeah.
Is it a relatively intact forest, or has it been?
Yeah. This place is. I've never seen so many elephant trails. You hear herds of elephants coming through in the night when we were right inside, and I think at least three times, the person at the front, me once, saw gorillas heading off into the distance. And you see gorilla nests all over, and gorilla handprints and footprints on the ground. So these peatlands are some of the last strongholds for the megafauna, so for elephants and gorillas on this side of the border, and for chimpanzees on the DRC side. I think people used to think that there wasn't that much wildlife there because it's so wet, but actually it's all somehow, I don't know quite how, but it's all adapting to it. So I was just in DRC a couple of weeks ago, and people were bringing me tortoises on the transit, and I think, how is this surviving when it's really wet? But obviously, you know, things are adapting there to live in these wet conditions. So yeah, there's lots and lots of wildlife there, and I think for gorillas and elephants, they particularly like it because the tops of the trees are not so tall, so actually they have more access to food than they would in a terra firma forest, or easier access to food. So we got our transects, and really we want to estimate where our peatland is. So we need to map vegetation based on our relationships between our vegetation on the ground and our presence and absence of peat. Then we combine this with our remote sensing products, as I've already explained, both optical and radar. And then we train a maximum likelihood classification on 2/3 of the ground data, holding a third back, and then repeat that process 1,000 times on a supercomputer, and then we have 1,000 estimates of every 50 meter by 50 meters across the whole area about whether it's peat or not. And then we can use that probability to produce a peatland probability map. And then we colour in all the places where we have a 50 or more percent probability of it being palm swamp with peat underneath or hardwood swamp with peat underneath. So this is our map, and this has been our sampling area. And we think it's around 145,000 square kilometres, so about the size of England. So a huge, huge area of peatland that we didn't know existed before, and so important in terms of wildlife, that was already known. We can also then use our peat depth, bulk density, and carbon concentration data from the laboratory analyses of the peat cores, make a first estimate of the carbon stocks, so 30 billion tonnes of carbon, so that's around 20, the equivalent of around 20 years worth of the fossil fuel emissions of the United States. That's a huge amount of carbon that's stored there. Although, because we've only sampling in one area and we have limited peat depth measurements, which is the key uncertainty in the sensitivity analysis, our 95% confidence interval is huge. Relates to the limited amount of data we have on peat depth. The accuracy of our map in terms of peat presence or absence is pretty good. So we're pretty sure about the area, we think, but not necessarily about the stocks.
Do you have a theory of the distribution? Why do you get the hardwood swamps up near the top and the palm swamps?
So the theory is that over time, you go from this hardwood swamp to a more kind of mineratrophic, so some nutrients from the original soil, to an ombrotrophic, so entirely rain-fed system, and you move towards a palm-dominated system. And what you see over time, you see over space. So on the outside, it's more hardwood swamp, and then on the interior, more palm dominated, and that's what you see on this side. But this is obviously geomorphologically quite different, so we really need to sample here to see if this is really peat forming, because we expect it from the remote sensing data, but you know, this is a long way and obviously quite different from where we sampled these large interfluvial basins. So just to put these new results in context, so that 145,000 square kilometres puts it as the most extensive peatland complex in the tropics. There is actually more peatland in the whole of Southeast Asia, but it's split up over various islands and a lot of it has been destroyed. So it's much more than what's on the whole island of Borneo. It's a really small part of both Democratic Republic of Congo and the Republic of Congo, but stores about as much carbon as the vegetation that the entire two countries put together. So it's extremely carbon dense. It's about a quarter of the world's tropical carbon in tropical peat is in the central Congo, and it increases the total amount of peat carbon in tropical peatlands by around 36%. So it's an important revision in terms of the global understanding of tropical peatlands. So there's a question of we know that this exists, and there's a question about what's the future of these peatlands. We know very well what's happened in Southeast Asia. You have widespread drainage and conversion to oil palm plantations, and that's happened very quickly. So about 25 years ago, Southeast Asian peatlands were relatively intact. The Indonesian mega rice project started in 1996. Today, it's a significant global emitter of carbon from the fires on these peatlands. And in El Nino years, this can be really high rates of emissions. So there was a study from Southeast Asian peatlands in the fire season of the 2015-16 El Nino. The daily emissions from the peat fires were greater than the fossil fuel emissions of the entire European Union. And this is set in train and is now very difficult to shift. And currently, Congo peatlands are intact. There's very, very little happening inside the peatland area, but that could all change. So a few weeks ago, we published the first threat assessment as part of a special issue on tropical peatlands, threat assessment of the Congo Basin peatlands, tried to draw all the information together to understand what the potential threats are. And I was really surprised because, you know, I previously said when we first published it, it's all intact, you know. And actually, once the paper was out, people kept emailing me and saying, do you know about this? Do you know about that? So this is logging concessions, and the logging concessions on the DRC side of the border, about 20% of the peatland area is covered by logging concessions. Now, there's been a moratorium on logging since 2002. So these are not active logging concessions now, but the DRC government is discussing seriously lifting that moratorium. And that moratorium may be lifted, paid for by the international community, the Norwegian government in particular, the CAFI program. And there's a question about what happens to these logging concessions that are over the peatland area. So this is a near-term threat that hasn't happened yet. And you can see, doesn't come out great on this map, but here is a hatched area of an area about 50 kilometers by 50 kilometers. And this is an oil palm concession on top of the peatland. So this has also been given out as a concession, but has not started yet. And it was given out before we published our peatland map and paper. So again, the oil palm is increasing in production across Africa, and it's going to come from this direction, and this is the first one to be given permission. So again, it's not been impacted yet, but that could change very soon. Areas where you have basins and peatland, then you typically have basins for a long time, and therefore you have oil deposits underneath. There's also most of the areas covered by oil concessions. And on the Republic of Congo side in 1 and 2, there's been early exploratory drilling for oil in the peatland area. So again, this is another potential threat to the region. But I should say there's also there's quite a lot of goodwill since we produced this peatland map about keeping these peatlands intact from lots of stakeholders and lots of policy makers. In terms of protected areas, so not only focus on the negative side, there are some larger areas. This has just been expanded to include some of our field sites as part of the community reserve. So there are some, it's around 11% of the peatlands that we've mapped are in protected areas. And, you know, to be graphic about it, this is the fear of what's happened in Southeast Asia. So huge industrial conversion of peatlands and draining of them to plant oil palm. And then this can set off a series of interactions that can drive more fires and more loss of carbon and losses of biodiversity through both conscious and accidental setting of fires in the dry season. And these peat fires can, can travel long distances by burning the peat underground and then pop up again. So you need to avoid this kind of uncontrolled situation in the DRC. And it's worth thinking that this is this could occur by accident. So this is a photo of a logging camp and a road, and they are not interested in this peat swamp or this light green. They're going to log this and for tens of miles out from here, this base. This was taken in 1988. Since we produced the paper and people started thinking about this peat swamp, this is what it looks like now. This was taken at the end of 2017. So what we think has happened, this is only one instance, but what we think has happened is that this road was built with no drainage apart from for this small river, and has changed the drainage pattern of this area and has killed the peat swamp vegetation going around 50 kilometres up this tributary. So in a huge amount of destruction from not thinking about these peatlands and not thinking about the drainage when land use change is occurring outside the peatland area. So this is in the Republic of Congo on the edge of the peatland area in the northwest. And again, it's only come to light since we started talking about these peatlands. So we hadn't sampled in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and we really wanted to know what's happening there. And I gave a talk at the Interstitial Climate Change Talks in Bonn, and talked to members of the government and some NGOs, and they were saying, "What's the next step? What do you need to do?" And I said, "What I really want to do is just test our map in the DRC, because that, knowing that the map is doing a reasonable job, then it can be more use to people." So here's ROT and DRC, and in November this year we went to this area, this kind of discrete area of peatland is this. So we wanted to test our map, see whether we were doing a good job in terms of the peatland. So Greenpeace International helped organise the trip with the DRC government, and we fly to Bandaka, and then we will work out of this village Lokoloma. So what Greenpeace failed to tell me before I arrived in DRC was that they brought two plane loads of journalists with them from all over the world, and they were going to watch me find peat for the first time in DRC. So the pressure's on. Whether your map is any good or not is, you know, can you go to an entirely new country in different conditions and still find your peat and do it all in front of the cameras? So this is environment editor The Guardian John Vidal explaining in Bandaka what we might find. And the other thing was interesting about this trip was that everyone wanted to do it except me in end of October to be able to have the results for the climate change talks in November. So it makes perfect sense, apart from, as I showed before, October is the wettest month and the worst time to go into the swamp. So this is an early part on the road where the road's flooded, and we're not even close to Lokoloma yet. But we get to Lokoloma, and Greenpeace International and Greenpeace Africa have done an incredible job with the local villagers. I've never had a welcome like this before, and I probably won't. So the indigenous peoples from Lokoloma gave us a huge, huge welcome. And this is Valentin Egobo, community leader, and this is French documentary team who made a documentary about Valentin and myself in terms of the peatlands and what it means, both globally in terms of carbon and also locally in terms of people's interaction with the palm, with the peatland. This is Joseph Katanga, who's an advisor to the Minister of the Environment in the DRC, who also came on the trip. And he's explained to two Chinese journalists and a German journalist about their view on the peatlands. So this is a big learning exercise for everyone, having indigenous peoples, journalists from really all over the world, and the government and Greenpeace all together to discuss these peatlands. There were so many of us in this village that we kind of turned it into a kind of mini Glastonbury. An awful lot of people involved. And then here's Greta Dargy leading the way as ever into the peatland from the village. And here we all are, snakes of us going into the swamp. And then we use our peat corer. And it does appear that there's peat exactly where we say the beginning of the peat is. And it's pretty hard to get right down several meters down, so half the village seems to be involved, apart from this little kid. He's like, what are you all up to? And then you get the peat out and then open out the cora to the... there's journalists standing all around this, so this looks like kind of very natural photo. With the peat, and actually we found 3.5 meters of peat really close to the village. And I would have, my fear was that I thought we would find some peat, but I thought it might be like 0.5 meter or something. So, and I have a student who's back there, and he's there now, and he texted me on from the sat phone. And says that they've already found 6 meters of peat going in from Lokolamba into that round area. So it could be even more carbon there than we first thought, at least from this one location. And there's the relief that we all found the carbon when we found the peat when we had pressure from journalists, two plane loads of journalists from around the world. And then we try and explain the results and what we're doing to the local village, to both the kids, who are pretty easy to explain to it, and much more sceptical women from the village about why we're playing around with the mud, and explaining it to the village leaders. And then just to finish off, Greta and I went as part of the delegation for the Democratic Republic of Congo to the climate talks in November. And this is Amy Ngongolo, his name right, the Minister for Environment for DRC, who in his main plenary address of all the countries talked about the peatland and the need to preserve it and the importance to preserve it, and said, like all humanity, understand the importance of peatlands to climate change. So while the situation appears to be changing fast, there's certainly goodwill from a number of actors to keep at least most of these peatlands intact. So I'm very happy to ask any questions, and this is Greta Dargy, who's done most of the hard work on this, working late into the night as ever. Thank you very much.